Hello. In recent audio snippets, we've been talking about the legislative process as it would be carried out under a new American constitution in such a way that there is no dependence on any specific people or power clots, as we've called them, but instead we having a system where every member of that House of Commons that we're calling it would be able to contribute their ideas with proposing bills and having a process that allows each member of the House to get his or her ideas out there and have them democratically voted on without having to depend on a specific person or a chairman or chairwoman to or speaker of the House to have his or her ideas promoted. And in the midst of that, we began to talk about how we could have a fairer and a more a sounder budgeting system where instead of having this monolithic budget full of pork, the budget would be gradually built out through bills that follow the same process as any other bill, and that's how the spending would be defined through in bill after bill, with each bill focused on a specific topic and a specific spending allocation associated to that one specific topic, and each bill would be voted on individually, and that's how the budget would be filled out. And then we began to talk about the other side of budgeting, in other words, taxation, and we began to speak about how the new constitution needs to be much more specific about the issue of taxation. We saw that the current American constitution is very, very ambiguous and lacking in terms of putting any restrictions or limitations or any parameters around taxation. And it's kind of ironic because, as we all know, the American Revolution began out of Americans' complaint to George the Third that they were being overtaxed. Given that that was one of the driving causes of the eventual independence of America, it's ironic that after America became independent, there was really no effort to properly define taxation to prevent any American government doing the same thing that the colonies were complaining about to Britain. So the new American Constitution will need to define taxation and put parameters around it. And one of the things we began to see or say is that it's very important to simplify the tax system. And we spoke of having a very, very simple system where you can, an income tax system where you have a minimum amount, a deductible amount, shall we say, and we just gave out a number like 36,000. That's just a number to give an idea, and that $36,000 a year that would be considered what you need to subsist in America, and after those 36,000, then any additional income that you receive will be taxed at a very flat percentage. And we gave a maximum, a constitutionally maximum amount of 20%, let's say. So the Constitution would say you cannot charge or collect more than 20% of the taxable income from anyone. And and we also spoke about tariffs and the possibility of just having the constitutional reference to a value-added tax, but hopefully won't be a need to implement such a tax. But I believe it's technically valid to have such a tax. But I'm not quite sure what circumstances would merit imposing a tax like that, since it tends to create more bureaucracy than it should. And we said that there should be no sales tax because sales taxes violate one of the principles that would be laid out in the new constitution, that taxation should not affect the economic process. And we saw how, or we briefly spoke of how sales taxes create an additional tax for each layer of the production process. And that forces people to not distribute labor more efficiently. And so the tax is becomes a factor you think about when it comes to how you make the product, and that should be wrong. That should never happen, that a company decides, how are we going to build this product, thinking about how the government is going to tax our activity. That should be wrong. We should produce the product in the most efficient way possible, and we shouldn't go for a less efficient route just because that leads to less taxes. So we made it cheaper to be more inefficient, and that is just completely anti-logical, and it creates poverty in the long term. So a sales tax is not neutral. It's not economically neutral as a tax, and therefore such a tax should not be legal in the American landscape. And that's a little different from, a value added tax. A value added tax does not technically affect the process because it taxes only the value that gets added along each stage of the production, and that's why it doesn't violate that principle. So we spoke about a lot of little things like that, and in this audio clip, we'd like to speak about taxation at a more general level, just to give some additional parameters that should be included in the Constitution to ensure that taxation never is abused ever again. And the first thing we'd like to say in a general sense about taxation is that taxation, everything that is done legally, any bill, any action by the government must be supported by what I'd call the 10 pillars of our government system. And we'll talk about those pillars in greater detail in future audio snippets. So we're not going to go into the details of what those 10 pillars are right now, but just for the sake of taxation, taxation should be based or the concept of taxation is justifiable from two of the first five pillars. So these 10 pillars, five define authority. There are five pillars that you can set up to define the nature of authority and how it should behave, true authority. And then the other five pillars are basically the five rights of the individual. There are five basic fundamental human rights, and they should be laid out clearly in the Constitution. The Bill of Rights is clearly a disaster when it comes to really properly defining the bill, the rights of the individual. Yes, some of the actual rights are included in the Bill of Rights, but even those that are included are included in a very obscure and very convoluted way, and because it's not there, those rights are not there clearly laid out as principles, well defined and well established. Then the right is kind of there, but it's not clear enough to be to truly defend our rights. And we're seeing the collapse of the American system in front of our eyes at the time of this recording. And even though, as I always point out, you know, we conservatives always blame the evil liberals for what is happening. Yes, they are responsible at the external level. At the deeper level of things, the reason why we are in this mess is because the Constitution never really, really defined the rights of the individual in a clear way so that they could have been protected all along without having to reach these extremes that we're reaching right now. So there are 10 pillars, 5 pillars define the nature of government, and the other 5 pillars define the 5 fundamental rights of the individual. And taxation as a principle is validated by 2 of the 5 pillars of authority. Pillar number 1, and we'll just mention them very briefly without going into too much detail. Pillar number 1 is, this will sound like a tautology or something so simple that it's not even worth mentioning, but it is a very fundamental thing that should be clearly established in the Constitution. Pillar number 1 of authority is that true authority exists and it can be found. And you say, why would we need to say such a abstract and simple thing like that? Well, because basically that one pillar says to the population, to the individuals of this nation, hey, there is such a thing as authority. Authority, in other words, something that you are to respect and honor and submit to. And that authority, there's something such an entity, you could say, as true authority, and it's out there and it can be found. It's a concept that's independent of us. We don't define authority however we please so that it fits our needs at the moment. No. There is a true authority, and as a concept, however you want to think of it, and that true authority exists outside of us. We do not define that authority. We are to find it. Just as the objects exist outside of our own consciousness, and those objects don't stop existing when we stop existing. You know, when people die, the world just doesn't disappear. The world continues because the world has an independent existence. And by the same token, there is a true authority out there, and we are to find it. It exists, and whatever shape it has, or however it looks like, it is out there, and when we find it, we are to honor it and submit to it. And so that's pillar number 1, this awareness of a true authority that's out there and that can be found, and that's very important. And we'll see in other audio snippets that was a very that was one thing that the founding fathers and the philosophers that they depended on denied over and over again, especially John Locke. And we'll talk about that in more detail in future audio snippets. And that very subtle detail has contributed to the mess we have now. And you say, how does that little thing become such a big problem? It seems like such a silly play on words, and how can it have any pragmatic, real life, tragic consequence? And it does. Believe you me, it does. And we'll talk about that in a future audio clip. But the important thing is this: this pillar says there's a true authority, whatever shape it has. Maybe we're not too clear on it right now, but it's out there. And it can be found. We can pursue that true authority and come to know that authority and know what that authority looks like and how it behaves when it's true authority. So that's pillar number 1. And that validates taxation, because it says, okay, there's some authority out there that we are to submit to and respect and honor. And because of that, then taxation is a way of honoring or respecting that authority. So if government has true authority in it and doesn't necessarily have it, just because something has the name of government or the name of authority doesn't mean it's true authority. But wherever you find authority manifested in a true form, that true authority deserves our honor and our respect, and therefore it deserves a measure of our own income. So that justifies just a very basic notion of taxation, that we are to give to true authority a certain portion of our income just because that authority deserves it. So that's pillar number one. Pillar number five that justifies taxation is basically says, and we'll go into that in greater detail at some other time, is the authority, true authority, can assume the form of weak vessels that might even have little power. Basically, in other words, pillar number five is almost like the opposite extreme of pillar number one. Pillar number one speaks of this abstract concept of true authority that's out there. So it's very, it sounds very vague. And pillar number five is like the opposite, saying, hey, yes, there's this abstract, invisible, intangible concept of true authority, but it takes tangible form in the form of weak vessels, you know, weak people, and authority can be kind of housed in a weak vessel, even if that vessel doesn't seem to have too much power. And just to give you a quick example, consider let's say a teacher who teaches at a very high level, you know, private school that's very expensive, where you know the kids of millionaires go, and this teacher is maybe, you know, paid a decent amount, but he is let's say middle class. He really is not making that much money compared to the kids that he's teaching. He might be teaching millionaires, the kids of millionaires and billionaires, but he himself is, you know, just a middle class, lower income type person. And so he might not have owned any company. He might not be some CEO of some big corporation. But when he's in that classroom and he's standing in front of those little kids, even if those kids own half of the planet by inheritance, at that moment, that weak person who doesn't have the same level of power that these kids have deserves the respect of these kids, and he deserves to be seen as an authority that should be obeyed and honored. So you have like an example there of a weak vessel that has little power, but the fact that he doesn't have much power doesn't mean that you should not honor him. And that's a problem with third world countries. If you look in you know, corrupt countries like in Latin America and in other parts of the world, the concept of authority always hinges on who has the power, who has the big stick, who can beat you up. Oh, if you have a big stick and you can beat me up, then you have the authority because you have the power. And that's how you know, a third-rate civilized societies function, where authority is equated with power. So if someone has a lot of power, then they garner a lot of authority and respect from people. If they have little power, then they get respect from no one. But we have to operate under a different system. And in America, in a sense, we have operated more or less under that fifth pillar, even if it's not written in the Constitution. In many ways, we have operated like that, but that pillar is falling apart on us, especially because it's not clearly laid out. And right now, we have a lot of people who are exercising a lot of power and pretending to have an authority they do not have, and they're using their big stick to oppress people. And I'm speaking, obviously, of the Democrats, who are fascistically oppressing those who disagree with them, censoring them, and silencing them, and trying to turn themselves into the American version of the Mexican pre-party. And those of you who might know a little bit about the sad history of Mexico know what I'm talking about. The thing is that with pillar number five is that If you see a police officer, maybe it's not a man, maybe it's not like a 6'8" tall fellow, you know, 280 pounds standing there, you know, telling you to respect the law. Maybe it's this 5'2" tiny lady, but she is a police officer. And even though she does not have the power to beat you up and put you in jail, she has authority in her, and you are to respect her just on account of that authority. Obviously, if she's abusing that authority, she loses that clothing over her, that cloak of true authority. But assuming that she is a good person and doing her job correctly as a police officer, then you respect her for what she is, despite the fact that you could maybe, you know, beat her up and go away. So pillar number 5 says, authority can assume the form of weak vessels with little power, meaning that you don't equate power with authority. Authority exists, and it's not just this abstract concept. It can be incarnated, shall we say, in weak vessels. And even if they don't have the power, but you see that they have authority, then you are to submit to it. So taxation says, okay, yes, there is authority that you must honor with your income, and this income may have to be given to tangible weak vessels. So it's not just this money that you're giving to this abstract entity that no one knows where it is. No, you recognize that it will take tangible form in weak vessels, and that these are to be the recipients of our taxation. So taxation is based on 2 of these 5 pillars of authority, and it's also restricted by 2 pillars of the individual. Maybe it's not the time to mention the 5 basic rights of the individual, but we have shared in previous clips 2 of them. If you've been listening to these audio snippets, one of them is the right to property, which, as we described in great detail, is not in the Constitution, which is, to me, to this day, still astounding. Even though I know it, every time I say it, I'm confounded by the sadness of that statement. That the U.S. Constitution, the Constitution of the country with the greatest capitalistic system in the history of mankind, does not at any moment define or defend the right to property. And that's why we have all these commies, communist sons of bitches from the Democrat Party. And you might may say, oh, what a vulgar way of saying it, but I'm speaking conceptually, not just as a derogatory term. When I say that word, I am referring to something very specific conceptually. So I'm not just saying it as a vulgar term. So these sons of bitches, these sons of female dogs, who are running roughshod over the country and spending like drunken sailors and doing all these things. They have no respect for the right to property, and all they believe in is redistribution of wealth, and they always get a cut of that redistribution as they redistribute it, because the Constitution never bothered to define the boundaries of what property is and defining it as a right, as a fundamental human right. So taxation has to kind of battle with that right, the right to property. I have a right to my property, but at the same time, I am being required to give away some of that property to this true authority. So taxation is restricted by that right to property. So you cannot overtax people, because the moment you cross a certain line, then you are violating their right to property. So taxation is clearly limited by that. And it's also restricted by another of the 5 fundamental rights, and that would be the right to life. And as we shared previously, that's another right that's not in the Constitution, sadly enough. As we said, if you murder someone, you could murder someone here in the U.S., and still technically you have not violated that victim's constitutional rights, because the Constitution says absolutely nothing about life. And we also mentioned that life as a right is more than just the right to your physical, biological life. It's the right to live your life with freedom, with happiness, to pursue your goals, the desires of your heart as best possible. So freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and all these things are part of that right to life. And yes, they are mentioned in the Constitution, but because they are mentioned as a laundry list of things instead of defining the more general concept and then maybe listing those things as examples, because there's no generic concept of the right to life, then we have the mess that we have with abortion and all these other things that have been happening. That right to life also is another restriction on taxation, because if you overtax people, you take away their money, too much of their money, and then they will be left with little power to spend on the pursuit of their happiness. If you don't have money, you can't travel. You don't have the money to pay for the ticket to travel to where you want, for example, or you can't go out to eat in a nice restaurant because, you have to pay the government. So clearly, taxation has to take into account those two rights, the right to property and the right to life. And true authority will look at how much it's taxing and say, oh, no, I can't tax anymore because I'm going to start infringing on the right to property, or I'm going to start infringing on the right to life. So taxation is supported by two pillars, two pillars of authority, and then restricted by two pillars from the other side, from the pillars of human rights. I hope that's making sense. And these basic concepts should be in the Constitution. And it's important that when we write this new Constitution and we lay out these 10 pillars, that every bill that gets passed give out, like at least in a short paragraph, a quick explanation of what pillars, which pillars support or give validity to the bill. Like, for example, if a bill is to, let's say, open to build a park so that people can go there and sit down and relax, then the bill can make a statement that says, okay, this bill is to promote the right to life so that people can have the freedom to go with their families to the park on Sundays or whatever. Every bill should try to make to go back to the fundamental 10 pillars. And give it a justification for its existence, and that should be a habit, because that way we never forget the pillars, and that should be part of it. It should be constitutionally required that every bill or every action of government, official action of government, define what pillars it is founded on. So now that we've mentioned these two general concepts the pillars that taxation is based on and that taxation is restricted by, let's just go into more detail about something we mentioned earlier about progressive taxation, and that progressive taxation should is destructive and should never be allowed in the Constitution. And I think it will automatically be eliminated if we specify a flat tax. Let's say I'm just giving a number of 20%, and even that number sounds a little bit too large, but let's just say it for now. And so we will define a flat tax, and the Constitution go out of its way to say any type of progressive taxation system is immoral and unconstitutional. And as you know, a progressive tax system is a system where, for example, it breaks income into brackets, and they say, okay, any income between $40,000 and $50,000 is taxed at a rate of 10%. Then any income from $50,000 to $60,000 is taxed at 15%, and so on. And then when you get to the upper higher numbers, when you get into the hundreds of thousands and millions, then they start charging exorbitant tax rates. In other words, let's say, just to give an example, in some tax systems in some countries, let's say, if someone makes over $1 million, every dollar they make over $1 million gets, let's say, taxed at 50%. And that means that out of every dollar, extra dollar, the person receives an income above that, you know, above $1 million, 50 cents go to the government. He can only keep 50 cents. And it gets more and more outrageous as the brackets go higher and higher. And it's always been justified by the statement that those who make more need to give more. And when you listen to it, you go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, if you make more, yeah, then you should give more because you have more to give. But the statement is very deceitful. And that, you know, demon rats like to play with words and twist them and play psychological games with them all the time. And that's precisely what they do when they start talking like that. Because if you have a flat tax rate, let's say of 20%, obviously, if you make $1 million of taxable income, that's going to be $200,000 of income you're going to pay, of taxes you're going to pay. Imagine that. Out of $1 million, giving away to the government $200,000. That's a ton of money. And if you only make $10,000 of taxable income, you only pay $2,000. So yeah, if I only make $10,000 of taxable income, I pay $2,000. If I make $1 million of taxable income, I pay $200,000. So clearly, whoever makes more is giving more, much, much more. So just by having a flat tax rate alone, you already are fulfilling that requirement that people give out there that, yeah, if you make more, you should give more. Well, you are giving more, a lot more. But what they are doing is, no, we not just more. We are asking you to give more than the more that you are already giving. And what happens when you have a progressive tax rate is that it violates a very important principle, and this should be in the Constitution. It's important that the Constitution have very clear parameters on economics, and that's one thing the Founding Fathers never even came close to putting into the legal system. And that's why we have the sons of bitches Marxists out there, Cuba-loving, worthless bastards, who are destroying the economy and trying to turn this into some socialist nirvana. Because the Constitution says nothing about the economy. So one of the things that should be in the Constitution, and that will be, is that the authority apparatus, whatever system of authority we have, and the economic system must recognize and respect the importance of economies of scale. And many of you may know, what that refers to. Let's say if you have a field, a large stretch of land, arable land, and let's say that land is owned by 20 families, and they have, they all have the same amount of land, so they all get 1/20th of that big stretch of land, and so that you basically have 20 little farms inside that stretch of land. Then each family will, try to grow their land, their crops and everything, all by themselves. But because their farms are so small, they won't have enough. Even if they, are successful for a few years, it will take them a lot of effort to be able to put together enough money to buy, some sort of special tractor that will help them to harvest more quickly, or produce more, or have some sort of special farming equipment that will optimize the production of the farm. They can't invest in machinery and things like that, technology, to make their farms more productive because they're so small. They don't have enough resources by themselves. But if that one stretch of land was owned by one family. It was just one big farm. Then that farm would be big enough to gather enough resources to buy all this heavy machinery, all this special equipment to make the farm more productive. So you end up with more production with less cost. So society starts producing more. And that's what happens with economies of scale. Economies of scale allow you to combine costs and reduce them. And when people can pull together more, a larger amount of money to invest and produce and start a company and do things like that, they have the luxury of doing certain things more efficiently, and it takes them less money to do the exact same thing. And that means society in general is able to be more efficient with its resources. And that's how we begin to prosper as societies. That's what happened, you know, for example, with the Industrial Revolution, when all this machinery started coming in to make the production faster, when people were able to invest in this machinery, which is expensive. But then once they invested in it, they were able to produce the same amount of products in less time and with less effort. Then society started abounding in all this product that was being produced. And because society spends less time investing in what it took it longer to produce, now it can channel those resources to produce other things. And then society becomes richer. And what happens in a free economy is that if you only have to spend $1 to produce what took you $10 of time and effort to produce, those $9 that are freed up will end up being invested in producing something else that would have never been produced. If you're worried about let's say you have a farm and you live off of what you produce from the land, and you're so busy in your little farm sowing your little seeds so that you can get your little vegetables, and then you gather enough of them to go to the market and sell them to buy a sweater. If you're just trying to get by day, you won't have enough money to go, you know, take a trip around the world. But what happens in a society where food becomes so cheap to produce, or clothing becomes so cheap to produce, when the basic necessities become cheaper to produce due to economies of scale, then there's more resources available to do things that you would normally not do, luxuries like travel to another country or buy some sort of a fancy technological equipment, things like that. And that is all the product of economies of scale. And what does that have to do with taxation? Well, and progressive taxation. What happens is when you have a progressive tax system that punishes people who are making income in the higher brackets, what you're saying is that you're not allowing these people to pull more resources to invest in companies and jobs and things like that. You are forcing them to give that money away to the government. So who becomes the pooler, for lack of a better term, of these resources? The government, the national government or state government or whatever. The government starts pulling these resources. And the problem is that if you give the money to the government instead of leaving it in the hands of rich people who have a vested interest because it's their money and they want to produce and be more prosperous. But if you, instead of leaving it in their hands, give it to the government, to the bureaucrats. Look, if you want to think of what government people look like, just go to if you're in America, just go to the post office. Look at this, at these unhappy, miserable, nasty people who are behind the counter, who treat you like dirt, and you know, because they are all union and they are arrogant and self-righteous. And I am saying this out of personal experience. And people who couldn't care less about you, all they want is to retire someday. They do as little as possible so that they can eventually retire and get their pension. people who have no interest in progress, no interest in advancing in efficiency. They're just bureaucrats, and you're giving all this money to these inefficient, arrogant, self-righteous people. How can you expect the economy to prosper like that? You're giving it's like giving money to an idiot. And that's what you do when you have a progressive tax system. You're taking money away from people who want to do something with that money and produce, and giving it to a whole bunch of bureaucrats who have no idea, who barely know what's in front of their nose, much less how to manage these billions and billions of dollars in a way that will actually produce and create prosperity for the for society in general. So you're violating the concept of economies of scale when you have a progressive tax system, because you prevent the pooling of resources within the private individuals who have an interest in investing. What does a government invest in? All the government does basically is spend. So you're giving it to a spender, and a stupid spender at that. So it's important that the Constitution protect those society resources and leave it in the hands of people who are interested in investing in making things more efficient, because they have a stake in the game. They're not. A lot of them are going to consume a big part of that income, obviously, but their consumption is going to be is going to create jobs for other people as they purchase and do all these things. They are activating the economy creating demand and creating industries and things like that in a dynamic way. But when you give it to government just spends it in bridges to nowhere, in these stupid projects, and then they start taking a lot of that money and funneling it into their own pockets. Look at the whore Pelosi, sons of bitches like that bastard from Nevada. I forget his name. He was the Senate Majority Leader. I hope he's dead. I think he's not, but that worthless whore who made a lot of money, and nobody knows how he made all that money, and clearly it wasn't from his Senate salary. Harry Reid, I think his name was. Cursed is he, worthless little son of a bitch. If you give all this money to all these corrupt people, you're just going to impoverish the economy. You're taking resources away from society and giving them to idiots who will not do what's right. So it's better when wealth accumulates in the hands of people who want to produce greater wealth with it, seeking efficiency and investing efficiently because they have a stake in the game. And that's why a progressive tax system shouldn't be explicitly unconstitutional. So that's very important. And the other thing that we kind of mentioned very quickly in passing is that double taxation and the taxation of equity should be unconstitutional. And that means that companies should not be taxed. And I know this audio snippet is running very long, but we'll just try to finish this concept quickly. This sounds outlandish and sounds very self-centered. How can a company not be taxed? And the reason is that, first of all, you have to think of it from an economic standpoint. Forget the metaphysical, conceptual, moral aspects of it. Just thinking of it from an economic standpoint, companies are not people. And again, I'm saying this from an economic standpoint. Companies are not people. They are entities. They are intangible entities. For example, just think of a bakery. Let's say that you have a person who starts a bakery. And he's very successful, and he's putting in 10, 12 hours a day, baking these cakes and selling them in this mall, you know, store that he has, and he's prospering. He's working his heart out, producing all these cakes and being successful at it. But he's tied to the job, and he doesn't get to do vacations and stuff. And even though his little company starting to accumulate money is getting income, that income is sitting in the bank, in some bank account. But he's basically just paying himself as an employee, so he's just making a regular income as if he was working for someone else, while that company that he has is accumulating all this money in the bank. But as long as he's not touching that money, it really is, it's as if it was not his, if you know what I mean. And let's say that he's a very entrepreneurial type of person, and he's making all this money from this bakery, and he goes, okay, oh, let me invest in this new machine, to make the bake the cakes more quickly or whatever. Or, oh, I'm going to open a store, another bakery, like 10 blocks away from here, because I saw this nice location that's available, and I'm going to put another store there. So he's taking all this income that's coming in and reinvesting it to make the company bigger, this bakery bigger and bigger. But all that time he's just working like a regular employee, and he's deriving a certain basic salary from his company. But other than that, he's not richer because of it. So all that income that's coming into the company should not, is just there as equity, and it would be wrong to tax that income, because it hasn't really entered the pockets of the owner yet. And it's better to leave it there so that it can continue being invested, so that it can produce jobs and create more wealth for the society. So if you start taxing that income, then you are taxing equity, and you're sapping life out of the economy as you're doing that. And the other problem is, when you let's say you tax the income of that bakery. So the guy pays taxes on it as income for the bakery, and then he takes from that money for himself. And because he takes it, and let's say he gives himself a wage increase, so now he's making more money doing all that hard work. So he's paying himself more now that he's taking that money that has already been taxed. And now he's giving it to himself. Now, when he declares his taxes, he has to pay income on that money again. And that's double taxation. And that should be unconstitutional. Double taxation should be unconstitutional. And in taxation of equity, money that is sitting there producing, and it hasn't yet become the income of an individual, that cannot be taxed. And that's what I was referring to when saying companies are not people. Companies are just these legal entities. If you say a certain company made a gazillion dollars, it's not that company, those gazillion dollars are sitting in some bank account. They're not someone's yet, until someone gets an income, a portion of those gazillion dollars, then it's income. Then we can talk about taxing it. Otherwise, it's just money that's owned by this legal entity that's not a person. So I hope that makes sense. So obviously, if a company has more equity, then or more profits, then the shareholders make more money, so they get paid better dividends. Well, yes, the moment they start getting paid dividends, then that's taxable income. But the money that's left behind, that will be reinvested, should not be taxed, because it is fundamentally wrong to do that. So when money is taken from disposable income and put into investment, it should not be taxable. So, for example, if I get an income as the baker. You know, I give myself an income for my job as a baker, and, but then I take part of that extra income and put it back into the bakery, then that income should not be taxed. So in other words, any taxation system that is fair will take into account that any income that you received that gets invested back into the economic system should not be taxed. So that that is not taxable income. But having said that, there should be stiff criminal and financial penalties for anyone who tries to use this as a loophole. In other words, because investment money that you invest is not taxable income, then people could start setting up these phony companies that are there, that they don't do, you know, these companies don't do anything, they're just fronts where people put in their money so that it kind of shields it from being taxed. And then in those companies, they buy cars and stuff like that and use the cars and buy houses and things like that. And then they claim, oh, the house belongs to the company. It's for companies, for the company's use, or this car is for the company's use, but it's really their personal car. That sort of thing should be frowned upon in the Constitution. And if the IRS, a new version of the IRS, finds out something like that, there should be stiff criminal and financial penalties for having done that. So that cannot be used as a loophole. But even in that scenario with the fake phony company, there are other things to take into account that there's no time to talk about here. So I think we've run way too long with this audio snippet. We basically talked about taxation, and we'll continue talking about it a little more in the next audio clip, and we'll talk about the Laffer curve a little more, that which we mentioned in the previous snippet, and I think it's important to talk about that a little more again, and how it's important that be included in a new in the new American Constitution. Thank you very much, and I hope this audio snippet has been of some help.